Hello and welcome to the Marketing Meetup Podcast. I'm Joe. Thank you very much for listening today. Today we have Tom Roach and Grace Kite speaking all about marketing effectiveness. Now this is a bit of a special format in that we had Grace and Tom interviewing each other. They're two verifiable legends of the marketing sphere right now. And are really genuinely pushing the industry forward with their thoughts, their opinions, and their research. Not only that, they're really nice people as well. So I think you'll really enjoy today's session. Today is a session that I'll probably characterize as somewhere between intermediate and advanced, which means to say that, like, even as someone who has been delving into the marketing sphere for as long as I have been, there were some concepts today where I was like, I'm going to follow up with that afterwards and go down a real rabbit hole of the things that they were speaking about. Which is exciting. It's great to surround yourself with people who tell you things that you don't know already. Before we get going, I want to say a big thank you to this week's featured sponsor, and that's Frontify. Frontify enable you to keep your brand consistent, combining elements of data, asset management, and also brand guideline storage in such a way where your team can collaborate on your brand and consistently do so super easily. I definitely check out Frontify because they've just also released a brand new study having surveyed 450 CMOs on when is the best time to invest in brand. Definitely take the time to check that out. And if you just heard that in the background, that is my daughter going mad in a very, very lovely way. With all that said, I hope you enjoy today's episode and take care. First question, and this goes to Tom to start off with. Can we understand what we mean by marketing effectiveness? Is there a bit of a potted history that you might be able to give folks just as they head into today's session, just for some context?
Okay. The potted history, I'm not so sure about the real, like, true deep history of it. I haven't studied it, but I imagine it does go back to the sort of 70s and the classic people like Kotler. So if you want to get into your classic marketing textbooks, that's probably where it all starts. The bit where I kind of pick up, though, is 1980s onwards, where the IPA Effectiveness Awards were established in 1980. So when you get into advertising effectiveness, which of course isn't all of marketing effectiveness, but part of it, the IPA's efforts from 1980 onwards to gather as much data on the effectiveness of advertising, really proved the value of advertising, proved that it works, obviously from kind of slightly selfish industry perspective. But that body of case studies, that's now 2000 case studies with the data bank that comes off the back of those case studies and those awards, is kind of unprecedented in the history of marketing and advertising, really. It's the thing that all of Les Burnett and Peter Field's work is based on. So you'll whenever you get those charts, say IPA data bank, that's where that data comes from. So all of the kind of history of what works or what has worked over history is in that body of work. And then that sort of movement to prove the power and value and commercial value of advertising, I think goes hand in hand with the measurement, which again, Les Burnett is kind of fully wrapped up in. There's a brilliant econometrician called Louise Cook, who's really the doyen of advertising econometrics. And she was at BNP DDB, I think it was probably called then, or it may have been the previous iteration of DDB. She hired Les. So she was an econometrician, hired him, trained him. So I think his degree was in, I want to say, it might even have been machine learning or physics of some kind. And then there's this kind of canon of brilliant econometricians who essentially were from Louise to Les to a whole load of others, including Grace, who was, I think, in some ways trained by Les and introduced us. So we were
by Louise, actually.
By Louise, right. So I can't remember exactly when we worked together, but it was on some IPA Effectiveness Awards when I was at Adam and Eve DDB. So back end of 2019, 2020. So that's when Grace and I kind of started to do stuff together. Not that we're part, I mean, I would put myself in the history of marketing effectiveness in any way. But there is this kind of long line of brilliant measurement people who come up through the advertising world. And it's an interesting kind of, there's this kind of, it's quite a bespoke, quite sort of small number of people who are really experts in it. And of course, that's been sort of turned into an industry, and the bigger media agencies have big econometrics and measurement capabilities that really have their roots in those individuals. So it's a really, I mean, you did say geek out, and we could go much deeper than that, but that's very positive on the advertising effect side.
Geeking out is good, and even if you don't put yourself in that bracket, then I'm sure we will, Tom. Grace, did you have anything to add there, just on what Tom has just spoken through?
Yeah, and I think it is all about measurement and being able to measure. And I remember in the 80s, actually, and the 90s, when we were doing measurement for the first time, and I actually, in my first ever job, had numbers on a dot matrix printer that I had to type into Excel version 1.0. And it was a bit after Les and Louise, but I always picture them in the 80s with kind of luminous pink socks and big dangly kind of earrings. I'm sure they weren't doing that, but that's how I picture it.
And that reminds you of the history of it will be connected with the history of data and computing and computing power. And so that also suggests what the future of it's going to be about. With AI, whatever we think of that in measurement terms. But when it, and the other question, which was like, what is marketing effectiveness? I think it's really simple. It's having a really clear strategy and objectives for your marketing, really, really strong approaches to measurement, which are going to help you understand how you're achieving those objectives, and then using that measurement to understand how where you are on that journey, and then feeding that learning back into the process of developing your marketing communication next time. So it's all about strategy for me. It's not whenever people talk about what does effectiveness mean, what does evaluation mean, I'm always keen to talk about how effectiveness is, it's a cultural thing, it's part of the whole process, it's not something that just happens at the end of a process, because I think it probably goes wrong if you're just talking to your measurement people at the very end, once you've developed your plans and your marketing material.
I love that. Thank you for that last bit there as well, because I think that sort of, certainly speaking from personal experience more than anything, you know, there's a lot of conversation around these things, and sometimes it can feel quite inaccessible. But even as a starting point there, just to sort of put a couple of sentences which sound incredibly simple and clear, really helps take us on the journey for the rest of today's session. So let me make my last question, and then I'm going to pass over to you, Grace, and Tom, to take it from here. So you both did a pretty cool thing not that long ago, where you famously collaborated on the third age of effectiveness on a big cool stage in Cannes. And basically it was this idea that there's never been a better time to be in marketing. Returns are on the up, and so I guess the question is, how do we know that, and why is it?
Grace, you better take that, right?
I'll take this one. Yeah, leave this one. So the first age of effectiveness, when we were doing sort of traditional things like TV or posters, radio, the second age, I guess, was when we first started using online media. And the third age is now, where we've been using it for a little while. And I recently was doing a speaking gig at a big crowd, and I said, hands up if you think the third age is better than it's ever been before. And, you know, some of the audience put their hands up. Hands up if you think the third age of effectiveness is worse than it's ever been before. And quite a lot of people put their hands up there too. And there's this thing where actually, do we know whether it's improving or not, whether the world is improving or not? So I went and looked at it, and I got together this data source with the IPA. Actually, I'm sitting in the IPA's basement today. They've got a really cool bookshelf behind me. And I looked into this with the IPA, collected through loads of data from lots of different econometrics providers, and looked at whether returns from advertising were improving or not. And what you can see in that data is that actually, the returns from advertising took a bit of a dive when we first started experimenting with online, when we were practicing, getting used to it, and we were moving away from things we knew how to do to experiment with these new things. But then after a while, somewhere around the middle of the 2010s, returns to effectiveness started going up again, and they've been going up quite quickly. So actually, the third age is better than we've ever had before. And we sort of dug into the ARC data, that's that econometric source I was mentioning, to say, where is this recovery concentrated? And it's concentrated where people shop and research and spend time online. So where they're reachable with online ads when they're thinking about their purchase. So that is where the learning has now taken place. And we're using online ads in quite a sophisticated way, getting the right options on things like objectives for social media channels, and moving away from formats that can be gamed by bots or targeting in the right way. And return on investment has just reached a new, stronger level. And in the Cannes talk, where Tom and I were very lucky to hang out with Les Binet, we also got a cut from the IPA data bank that Tom was talking about a minute ago to look at the long lens in their data. And what we could see there was that actually in that second age when we were learning to use online ads and returns were sort of going a bit downhill while we were learning, actually the horizons for payback were really, really short and getting shorter. People wanted their payback now, now, now. And there was a bit of a move away from brand building. But actually that also had a turning point in the mid-2010s. So another part of the reason for the recovery in effectiveness is that people are starting to balance the long and the short, or the brand and activation, or brand and performance, or much better than they did before. And that's another part of the turnaround.
I think you
So
it's a brilliant story, isn't it? It's a really brilliantly positive story. I sometimes feel like in these big industry narratives, there's a bit of like, oh, it used to be shit and now it's great, or vice versa. And
yeah.
I get whilst I was really, a big advocate of the part of the story, which is we are learning better to use these tools that we've got, and we're getting better at combining the foundational knowledge of how marketing works with some of the new technology. I sometimes get nervous that there's too much nostalgia in the industry, and that a lot of the narrative that you see put out there, whether it's there's a crisis in effectiveness, or the previous talk to ours the previous year had been called Triple Jeopardy, and it was like doom, doom, doom. And I don't really buy the nostalgia, or it's shit. It's been terrible, and now and we're going to hell in a handcart, whatever the phrase is.
Because humans make progress, don't we? You
Yeah,
know, we're not
progress
all
is
kind of going, oh, let's throw away the good stuff and keep the
no,
shit stuff.
of course. And I get quite like when there are people who just look back and just want to look back at the I love the TV commercials of the 80s and 90s. It's what I grew up with, right? I would, of course, I'd love to live in a world where there was some of that great creative work out on our big screens in our sitting rooms. That's not so much the case anymore. It's happening elsewhere. Creativity is moving on. Things move on, and we shouldn't live in the past. So I feel like I just want to temper the kind of things were shit, now they're great narrative with a bit of reality of I suspect 5% of everything is, or 95% of everything is mostly a bit shit, and 5% is really brilliant. And that's probably always the case, regardless of the time. But having said that, I absolutely do buy the stuff we were talking about, which is these new platforms, we're getting better at using them. The history of digital being initially and primarily a direct response set of platforms and channels, that is disappearing as creative people get a handle on how to do things creatively with it, and as video platforms become more the norm. And so video is baked into it. Obviously TikTok is video first, and YouTube was born that way, and video is where brand building is particularly prevalent. And so I'm kind of a big advocate for how we're all getting better at it. We're using the tools better. We're using some of the intelligence and the history of what works better, and just that there's a kind of progress narrative there, which I like.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And I think when you talked about it in terms of bothism, which is a term that's come about recently, it's been used by Mark Ritson and others. He riffed off your work with that, didn't he?
Yeah,
What
so I
does it
wrote.
mean to you?
Well, so I wrote a thing called The Wrong and the Short of It in, I actually wrote it in 2020. It was the first or second blog I published in the middle of 2020. And it got a lot of reads, and he read it and passed it around. And somebody in a comment when Ritson shared it on LinkedIn said, this thinking and the stuff you're doing, Ritson, will become known as the Bothism school. And so that kind of term was coined then. And yeah, Bothism, I was annoyed actually, because it's like, oh, I should have called it that. It's a really good philosophy. It gets to the heart of what, and my bit, by the way, on the wrong and the short of it, was really, it was just a rip off of Burnett and Field, which is my secret. My whole career is basically a little kind of rip off of Burnett and Field. But the Bothism was really to go, there's this word in the middle of long and short of it, which is obviously the great book by Burnett and Field, which gets forgotten, because Burnett and Field get talked about as being, I even saw them described as the high priests of the long term, which is of course ridiculous and pretentious, but also is wrong, because they both believe in both. The word "and" is in the center of the title of the long and the short of it, and that word gets ignored and forgotten. Their very famous chart that does that with that, it says, do both of those things and you will do really well. And actually the thing that I started to say was, I think sometimes in marketing advertising, we sometimes get it wrong, not only by being really short-termist, but there are other people that get it wrong by being really wrong, like long-termist, and only wanting to do the big brand campaigns and creating lots of demand or future demand, and they're not actually harvesting that demand through tactical use and smart use of digital channels to really harvest the demand they're creating. So it is about balancing, building future demand by creating the right brand associations for your brand, and then harvesting that demand really efficiently in the right channels for those.
There's people. A few analogies for it, isn't there? Like I use the one of, there's no point in having a really high tech fishing net if you haven't got a pool full of fish, and the brand building is putting the fish in the pool. And then the performance or the direct response activation is like fishing them out and turning them into customers.
It's a great one. I like, I think Ritson talks about, there's two ones he uses. One is watering your tree and then picking the fruits. And yeah, then the other one, which I like, is an alley-oop in basketball. So the long pass and then the dunk. Two things that can't be done separately. Well, you can probably dunk alone. I don't know. I don't know about basketball. But you can't, an alley-oop needs both those things. And it's a really good thing to do in combination. I think all of this theory is basically trying to make sense of this big change we've seen in advertising, which was, we used to have, you know, a couple of big tools to do the long and a couple of big tools to do the short. Now we have this vast array of platforms that were really started out being really good at the short. And now I think we're getting better at combining them and using digital for both. And of course, digital can do, digital means all sorts of things, doesn't it? But it's particularly, it was more famous for the short, and now we need to get better at the longer bit.
Yeah, and the two things do work together. You see that in the measurement as well. Like, I see that through our work all the time, that if you do brand building, you see the return on investment for your performance go up, and if you do performance and direct response, you see the overall effect of your brand building be able to last longer and be activated more. And it works. It's because, you know, you're harvesting the demand that you're creating from your brand building. And actually, it's really helpful, because that effect actually shows up in things that the performance marketing can see.
Yeah.
Performance marketing team can see. And that's important, actually, because sometimes they can be a bit of a blocker to brand building. They can go, well, actually, I don't really fancy this ethereal thing. I want to put a pound in and get £50 back. And they think it's really transactional. It's just like putting money in a slot machine and out comes more money.
And it can be like that, right? But then those pesky brand marketers on the other floor sometimes with different objectives are seen in somehow in conflict, or stealing their money, or there's a bit of conflict. I love it when I talk to marketing people and they have a combined team, they're unified, they have good relationships with their performance colleagues. They probably ideally got the same boss. They're being led by somebody that understands both. Maybe they are individuals that understand both.
Those are the most effective departments, aren't they? Where you've got the people meeting at the corner.
Totally. And they've got metrics and objectives that they're being set that are consistent and work together. are not conflicting, because of course we all know that that pressure of short-termism, and sometimes putting off the bigger things you could do, which are about casting the net wider and doing something big for the future. And that's, you know, in busy times, that's that all affect that that kind of problem affects us all in everything that we do, not just our marketing and advertising.
Yeah. And you've got, you just, you, I mean, the thing where I've seen it work, getting past those kind of blockages, it's just pointing out to the performance marketing team that, you know, things like your click-through rate on your search ads is going to go up if you do brand, or, and your dwell time on the site is going to go up. And that means your conversion rate on site is going to go up, and you're going to go up the organic rankings because of this brand campaign that you're doing. And all of that's going to make the performance marketing team's job easier and better. So they're going to look good as a result of it. And that's something that, like, just helps you move on a little bit.
That data is so important, isn't it? I remember maybe about 2018, I was trying to collate a sort of set of data and charts on the value of brand. And it was unbelievably hard to gather the right sources. I suspect now, in fact, we should look at it and do it again, because I bet you there's a load of great data points that you could pull out. Just the, you know, here's a brand that was doing some brand stuff as well as some more short-term stuff, and here's the click-through rate on the short-term stuff that was higher, or this is the, I don't know, the base sales are higher or whatever. That these are really interesting. I mean, there's probably a load of very specific data points that you've got in your locker, Grace, that could be useful to people to see, I think.
Well, that's a to-do then. We'll put that on a to-do list.
Occasionally look back at these articles I've written and think, oh, that's God, I wouldn't write that now, or that chart looks horrible, or that that data point looks about outdated, or I've changed my mind now. So noticing things is good.
These things that people are always still massively referencing because they're really useful to everyone on your in your blogs.
I need to update some of it because it's, you know, goes out of date, doesn't it, sometimes?
Yeah, I suppose. Well, talking about the to-do list, one of the things we've been talking about as a sort of kind of loose to do for this year is to kind of solve brand building in the platform world. Like, how do you do it? And you're I think we sort of loosely sometimes work where you think about creative sometimes, and I kind of sometimes think about media. We sometimes work that way together. I think you're further on thinking about how you're doing creative than I am, but I've got some ideas about how you do it in media. Do you want to say a bit about how you do it creatively?
Yeah, it's funny. The more I think about it, and the more, like, I mean, so, and that's really what I did on the stage at Cannes. So last year, my bit on the third age of effectiveness was basically going, I identified the, I mean, it's not a new problem, but this issue around attention is an issue in digital channels particularly, because the screens are smaller and the formats that we've got are shorter. So there is an issue around how many seconds of attention you can get from people when they're watching your advertising. And of course, we all know that the more you engage with a piece of content, the more you're likely to be to have your memories of that thing enhanced, or your perceptions of it reinforced in some way. So there is a connection between the amount of seconds of attention, which sounds quite mechanistic, and the amount of brand memories you're able to create. And the more memory you're able to create, the more chance of future sales you can create. So there is an issue with digital channels being just not quite as good as some of the, you know, as with a 30 second TV ad, you can get on average about 13 seconds of attention, apparently, according to some of the data. With a 15 second YouTube ad, it's about 6 or 7 seconds. With a Facebook ad, it might only be a couple of seconds. Bit of a problem, that, isn't it? And so with this array of channels we've got, we need to be really, I mean, I hate the word, but choiceful about the platforms we use and the formats we use. I'm pretty big on TikTok. I'm not big on TikTok. I'm bullish about TikTok because I think it's a really engaging and creative platform where loads of interesting things are happening. And when people are on TikTok, they seem to engage that bit more with the content, and that I think is a clue to what you need to be doing in digital. It's about video. It's about grabbing people. It's about being native to the platform as best as you can be. So all of the different platforms will tell you that the best way to be effective on their platform is to create content that's bespoke to that platform, rather than doing what some of the big advertisers still do, which is make your big tele ad and then chop it up into bits and stick it on the internet. That is not best practice. It's cheaper. It's kind of, it's an easier job. You don't need so many people to do it. It's a bit easier to organize. But the reality of doing creative work in each for the platforms is you do need to be pretty attuned to what works on each one creatively and in media terms. And so, I mean, probably starting with a couple of platforms which are video focused and getting really attuned to how your brand can operate in those platforms is the right way to do it. All the platforms talk about like grabbing people's attention, not necessarily just by some of the old rules that Meta would say was like, make sure your branding's up front, make sure your key message is there. I actually think that's a bit of a guaranteed way to only get 2 seconds of attention and not getting any more. Because once people know what brand you are and what you're saying, they don't need to watch anymore. But if you start off by really engaging people and intriguing them and giving them a sense of the value or that there is going to be value from continuing to watch, then that's a great way to start your story. And then the kind of, there's this classic learning. You two talk about emerging story arcs, so creating a high level of attention to start with and then multiple peaks of emotion throughout video, however long it is. And I think that's something we can learn from in terms of the way we construct our stories and tell stories in video particularly. So that's a bit of a kind of potted history. So I think it's about A, B, C, D, E. So attention, branding, communicate through stories, emotion is still really important. And I just missed out D, which is difference is still really important as well. So A, B, C, E, D in that case.
I love that.
I'm probably supposed to ask you a question now, and I need to look at the question.
Well, I was gonna have a go at what's the media thing for.
Yeah, please. Yeah,
and I mean, I must say that I think this is an area where we don't entirely know the answer. Like, how do we do brand building in a world where TV doesn't get the reach that it used to? You know, because it's always been the history, isn't it? You get a 30-second ad, you put it on TV, everybody sees it. It signals that you're big because everybody's seen it, and it signals that you're good. And then, you know, that's a really rich media channel. It's got sound, it's got visuals, it's got movement, and that gets into people's minds and they remember it. But that was the way you do brand building, you know, sort of beginner's guide, sketch out a brand building thing. It's probably got TV in it. But what about in a world where TV doesn't get the reach that it used to? Well, one idea is that because you can't reach everyone with broad reach TV ad anymore, you have to use lots of different channels. And you talked about different channels and how they're different in terms of the amount of attention you get and the mode, the mindset people come to them with, and how different creatives have to be different. And one idea I've got about the future of brand building is that actually that kind of fragmentation isn't necessarily a bug. It could be a feature. Like, the modern stack of media channels is a genius thing to be able to work with. And the data shows consistently, it's across a lot of different meta studies, that if you use more channels, you get a higher return on investment. So the more channels you've got in your campaign, the higher the return on investment that campaign will be. It's in the ARC database that I mentioned earlier, and it's also in the work by James Herman and Walk on creative commitment. And so the idea there is that if we can use different channels to do different but related jobs, we build up more rounded campaigns that build brands in different ways that are appropriate for different people. And we see it in our econometrics as well, that a lot of little works together to add up to more than the sum of the parts. I mean, there is an art to this route as well, as well as kind of the science. It's, you know, you have to get it right, you have to have something that's very consistent across all of those different places so that you're not confusing people or asking them to take on too many different messages. So there's a need for a look and feel consistency across the diverse platforms. So branding as well as brand building that matters. So that's one idea.
I love that. I mean, that, because we've been talking about this idea of lots of littles for a while, and I really like the justification for that being so important. And actually it has its roots in something have known for a while, which is multiple channels are good. It's just we've sort of maybe in the debate about what the hell do we do when linear TV reach is declining, this kind of crisis. I think one of the big crises that people have had in the industry has been around that, actually. And I think that's the kind
worry.
of it's the worry that, you know, we used to have this big bazooka, we don't have it, we still have it, but it's not quite so effective in reaching some of our new audiences, and we may not have the money for it. And how do you, when all the marketing science says try and be always on rather than big bursts, and TV was obviously, you know, historically been quite good at big bursts. I think it's really interesting, this kind of sense of creating our brands out of loads of little pieces, so long as they don't fragment and dissipate into nothing. And I think that's probably where the branding piece comes in, and the consistency of making sure everything you do is orchestrated and telling the same story, or telling a slightly new angle in on the same story, should we say.
So that it's a modern rationale for branding, a new reason for consistency. And you know, people have always talked about consistency over time, like keep the campaign for a little while so that it beds in. But also now consistency across platforms and all these little touch points sort of really, really matters.
Yeah, because when I was at BBH, we used to talk about moving it on without moving it off. There was always this crisis of, you've done a big thing, it was on brand, it worked, and it's begun to maybe work less well. When do we move on to the next thing? It was a kind of linear progression. I wonder whether now we're dealing with a situation where we've got lots of things happening together, and it's more about the connection points and how you move things on and off brands within or across the platforms in some way. There's a diagram that you and I need to create and work on.
Could I just jump in here? Because I just wanted to ask a question about, like, I love this point. I think it's really wonderful. And to me, as someone who sits within a slightly smaller business, you look at people like the Paul Dyson study, which sort of says about, like, the size of your business being one of the main determining factors of the success of your campaign. But as I hear you speaking about, like, lots of little works, for me, that gets me quite excited in a way, because I'm like, oh, as a small business, actually, you know, we could be doing lots of little smaller things, you know, deliver consistently. Granted, it's all relative to bigger companies who potentially, you know, can still do little but bigger, if that makes sense. But, you know, I'm interested in your perspective here, Grace. You know, does that open up a little bit of a gap for small businesses potentially in the historic sort of world of marketing literature and knowledge?
Yeah, I'm such a fan of smaller businesses. I mean, that sounds really, like, weird, because there's so many of them and that's almost all of the economy, but the smaller businesses are growing faster and they are the driver of the economy, and they are what contribute to how the country as a whole progresses, really. And it's a shame, I think, that many of the effectiveness speakers are actually relying on things like the data bank or econometric studies and things like that only big companies do, really. We were really lucky at Magic Numbers because we had a spurt of growth around COVID. So we worked with loads of scale-ups during that time because we were quite small and they were quite small, and it was a really good match, and it just all worked really well together. And so we've been sort of thinking about what's the right thing for smaller companies, and it's part of what's in our Scaling Up Works course that you flashed a QR code for at the beginning. But one of the things I wanted to pick up, because I think this is also a bit about the future of brand building, and it is something that's accessible to smaller companies, is the role of influencers as brand building media channels. Or, I mean, it sounds awful because they're people, you can't call them a media channel, but, you know, something that you might buy to help you get into back brand building. Because influencers, they're this new breed of, like, trusted people, and the thought is that we as smaller or sometimes bigger businesses could leverage their credibility for brand building. And actually, smaller influencers, the evidence is that micro influencers get you more bang for your buck, because every post that they do is more relevant for their smaller following. So you do a lot of micro influencers rather than one big one, and again, that's something that's accessible to smaller businesses. And I wanted to tell you, I've got a survey that WARC did last year, and I thought it was fantastic when I saw it, because they interviewed and surveyed, like, huge numbers of people around the world and asked them what they thought about influencers. And three quarters of people, sort of between 72 and 78% of people, were super, super positive about influencers. They believe that influencers promote products and brands in the follower's best interest. They believe that they promote products and brands that are reliable. They believe they promote products and brands that are good value for money. And that's what the followers believe about what influencers say. So it's no wonder really that spending on this has been growing quite rapidly. And it's also no wonder that we're seeing in our econometrics and in a lot of places that this is actually working like a brand building channel, that the effects of doing an influencer campaign like that is a long lasting. They're not just kind of now and gone.
I think on this point about, sorry, Jane.
No, go ahead, Tom. You've got good things to say.
What you have to remember is that Google and Facebook Meta, they are basically funded by millions of small businesses. They've created, they've made advertising accessible to small businesses. And the way they are actually set up is far more attuned to the simple, easy kind of plug in and play approach that a small business needs than a big advertiser. So in many ways, those platforms are better for small businesses, and I think it's probably part of this story is the way that small businesses are kind of able to advertise and again able to do something they couldn't really do before, because previously what would they do? Stick something in the Yellow Pages, something in the local post office, local papers. They didn't have access to this much wider audiences and footprint that digital gives them now. So that's a really big part of this. The other thing is, I just think this point about the IPA data bank is, and some of the data we use is based on the success of very successful companies, and they are the 0.01% of all advertising spend, probably, when it comes to the award winners at the IPA or Cannes or somewhere. The vast array of the whatever it is, $700, $800 billion worth of global advertising spend is not spent with those.
I mean, there are some parallels that follow over, right? So, so TV might work for big businesses because it's that rich media and you've got sound and movement and visuals. Online video is like that, but so you get the same kind of longer lasting effect. Yeah. But actually now small businesses can do it just with your phone, do a TikTok.
Completely accessible, isn't it? So my 15-year-old, he went into the local trainer store in Cambridge and he said, "Your TikToks aren't very good. I can make them better for you." And has managed to be part of a little team there that have grown their TikTok followers from 900 to 20,000 just in the local area. And half of those are like Cambridge locals, not like people globally who are just sneakerheads. So that's one small store with a tiny turnover. On a bad week, they will make more money from TikTok and views from TikTok than they will selling trainers. It's kind of unbelievable what's possible. And that's sort of, I think, bringing a lot of these different themes in. So there's a kind of influencer creator-led thing going on, small business, access to new technologies, to video. Almost free in terms of its ability to create content. I mean, he gets paid a tenner and then £2.50 for posting the video.
That's amazing.
I'm
going
to check it out now. I need some Box Fresh trainers.
Could I ask one follow-up question and I'll shut up, because I know that we've got a lot of interesting things, a lot of open questions from the community as well. But I saw a perspective shared by an influencer the other day who has accumulated a large following on TikTok, and their perspective was that when brands are working with individuals who are influencers or ambassadors, as the chat's going on, Q&A here, that the brand almost needs to throw away their brand guidelines and let the influencer be authentic and turn up as themselves and stuff like that. And I kind of don't think there's any better people to ask. You know, I read that and as a traditional marketing person, I went, oh God, you know, that's not a brand. Lose your brand if you allow folks to go completely off the rails.
Yeah.
But are we entering a different dawn of?
I think it's a really tricky area. So if you were to, I mean, you could go horribly wrong, right? By hire 1,000 influencers, let them completely loose. A load of those will be rubbish. They won't represent your brand in the right way. You will actually spend a load of money on not great reach and probably overlapping audiences. So I think there's something to do with making sure it's it, and let's not forget, this is really just a sort of modern, smaller version, democratized version of celebrity endorsement, which has been a classic marketing tactic forever. So this isn't new. It's just smaller, more agile, a bit more easy to do from loads of different people out there on the streets.
I think there's a slight difference, though, isn't there, in that, you know, influencers will do a better job for your selling your brand if they want to spend time with your brand. So if you can build a brand that people want to spend time with, then your influencer is going to bring them their authentic self and your brand to this party. Yeah. And that's what you want. And one of our brilliant clients at Magic Numbers is Little Moons, and they made a brand that people do want to spend time with, because it's like cool and kind of like Asian and kind of these funky little ice cream things. And actually, as a result, they were a TikTok sensation, and it whooshed their business from being tiny to being in every Sainsbury's and Waitrose and everything. And at the core of that was making a brand that people wanted to spend time with, and then the influencers jumped on it, and the content was authentic but also branded.
I love that story, because none of those all of those videos have the product at their heart. The brand name's there, you get people unwrapping them, free defrosting them. The stories that are being told in all those videos, even though most of them are just UGC, right, they're not being paid for, are of incredibly authentic to that product, demonstrate their product demos. So that's unbelievable. I love the next challenge that Little Moons now have, which is they gained loads of distribution as a result of that. How do they then keep that going? Well, the answer is bound to be paid advertising, because only paid advertising can guarantee you the reach, that all of that kind of you kind of grassroots user generated stuff created for them initially. I doubt they can make that happen again in organic. We have a lot of conversations at Jellyfish about how we combine the power of organic and paid advertising, particularly in social. So, you know, organic is great for kind of testing things, for little spikes of interest, and sometimes for reach. I don't think it's very good for guaranteeing reach on a permanent basis. You know, big businesses need predictable sales coming in. They need that stability, because they've probably got factories. You need to be planning ahead. Small businesses suddenly get overrun with that, and then they need to scale up. And I think I just think this thing about how you combine organic and paid in social into, and we call it one social at Jellyfish. It's a new thing, you know. There aren't very many people with experience of both, but again, it's another form of bothism, which I'm really interested in.
Part of the new world of platform-led brand building.
Exactly.
We probably won't solve it all before 10:30.
We've got 12 more minutes. I don't think that's gonna happen.
I love that. Maybe if we take our last planned question, and then we head over to the Q&A. Because there's some fabulous questions in the Q&A as well. And folks, if you want to give a thumbs up to any questions that you'd like us to prioritize, then we'll make sure that we take those. So I'll jump in here and just ask the last question, because it's an opportunity to throw it to both of you, which is, where do you see the future? What still needs to be learned? So Tom, maybe to you first.
Well, what still needs to be learned is, the first answer, that part of the answer is the fundamentals continually need to be learned and relearned and relearned and retold, because we forget them at our peril. Because it's very, very easy in any field, but particularly in marketing, we love shiny new things. And by talking only about the shiny new things, we forget the fundamentals, the basics, the things that will always be true. And I'm particularly interested in like the brain and humans do not evolve very quickly. The brain doesn't change very quickly. And so understanding how we get at the unchanging person, this is a really fundamental thing. So that would be my first part of the question. And then, so that's kind of exploiting what we already know, and then exploring the new stuff is all, we have to balance the old with the new, the known with the unknown. And so exploring new stuff, and that for me at the moment has to be around how we can use AI to do what we're doing better and faster and maybe even cheaper. The thing I worry about there is, I think we know that AI is going to make things cheaper and faster. Can it make things better? I think that is still slightly unknown. That will become better known over the next couple of years, I think.
Love that. Grace, over to you.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with that. I mean, I'm not sure about AI. We're using it to kind of soup up some of our processes. But a kind of bigger picture, I'm not sure where that's going, but that's definitely an interesting one to watch. I reckon the fundamentals, though, those unchanging principles you just put in the chat, that's really, really important. And then a layer on top of that for me is skills in being able to read the outside world and go, how do I understand the data that I'm seeing to moderate those unchanging principles for my particular context? And that could be, you know, how do I get the right balance between brand and performance? How do I understand what the data I'm seeing is going to do to help me relieve any constraints that are holding back my marketing? And these are really some of the areas that the two courses that you've put a QR code up for there, thank you very much, are kind of aiming at. And I think there's a lot marketing people can learn, and you know, we can get better at it. I kind of want the whole world to be more effective, and that's why I started doing training. Not because I've got nothing to do. I'm very quite chocker.
Deservedly so. I heard about your inbox before we started today's session, so it seems mad. Thank you both. It's been absolutely fascinating so far. I mean, we've got 9 minutes left, so I want to make sure that we get to some of the questions from the community. But honestly, I think as you were speaking, my mind just sort of went through to like the world's largest blog post, where there were so many rabbit holes that we could have gone down today. So thank you both for giving that. And I think we definitely positioned today as like an opportunity to start at the top and then sort of follow down any rabbit hole that sort of takes your fancy. So let's take some questions from the community, just to make sure that we're getting to what everyone would like to hear today. So the first one comes from Sarah, and Sarah says, I need to demonstrate the importance of brand to the shareholders in our organization who want any investment to be tied to the bottom line. I don't think you're alone in that question. Could you share any examples or stats that could help that and gives additional context of working in B2B professional services? But if you've got any broader examples of examples or stats that can justify investment tied to the bottom line. Or indeed not.
For
Maybe
me,
Grace. Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of things that are out there in the public domain about what brand building generally does, about returns on investments that you might get from different types of media channels and different types of investments. And there are also some fantastic case studies from businesses that your CFO or your board might aspire to be like. We both love the Amazon one, don't we, Tom? Because it's one where where Bezos sort of said, oh, we'll never do brand building. And then he turned out from his own data that he probably should, and so he does now. So we love that one. So some of those types of evidences could be really, really useful for your CFO. But what I've found over my careers is that senior people in finance and they're answering to investors in the city need it for this business. So benchmarks and case studies are kind of not enough. And in that case, the thing that really works is market mix modeling or econometrics. And you know, we offer that at Magic Numbers, and it's something where, you know, it's part of my job to get the grilling from senior CFOs in big companies and smaller companies as well. And actually, they do get it. They do get econometrics, and they do get that as a method, and they do buy into it. So that's really the gold standard.
And I'd agree with that totally. That I mean, there are some general, like, quite good blog posts about the value of brand, which you know, might help. But that's only the general stuff. So sometimes, like, just getting hold of a really good bit of data that's going to piss your CFO or finance people or investors off, like just how bad your awareness is often quite a useful one. Find just get a piece of basic data on the awareness of your main competitor or the leader versus your awareness, and that will they'll go, why are we only got 2% awareness? Well, we're not doing any awareness exercises. Why are we not doing that? Because we can't afford it. We need some money to do it. That's a really brutal and kind of basic thing, but sometimes just a really kind of bad bit of data and admitting it may be quite a good way to poke the bear.
I like that.
I like that a lot. It was a quote from Martin George from one of our webinars a couple of years ago now, which was "Speak the language of finance." And it's not the same as the answer which you've just given, but it does, remind me of similar shades of it.
Yeah, there's that, and that is a great bit of general learning as well. The IPA always talk about this particular issue, and they have great training on this sort of topic. There's one thing I like, which is like ask them where, and this is more of a personal thing, like ask them where they got their Rolex, and why do they choose their Rolex? Why did you choose that brand? Why do you drive that car? So they understand just in personal and human terms the value of brand. So it just takes them out of the spreadsheets a bit.
Love that.
I
The
like
next.
that. I'll meet them in the spreadsheets. You take them away from the spreadsheets.
Well, it's funny, we talk about system one and system two in marketing, don't we? And system, but our approach is to persuading people and selling them what we want them to do and to help us with tend to be system two. So how do we find system one ways of tapping into their emotions, tapping into their more human side or their personal side? And I think that both the examples I've given probably do come at it that from that perspective.
Nice. I like that. There's a comment mirrored to that in the chat here from Paul, who says, "I'm a strong advocate of, in brackets, sometimes scaring the crap out of people to get action," which I like. There's a follow-up to this question, which is in a similar vein, but maybe asked in a slightly different way, which comes from a great strategist in Rob, who asks, "If bothism is so obviously effective, why are so many CMOs, despite their brilliant communication and persuasion skills, unable to convince CEOs slash MV FDs to invest in brand? Which bit of convincing evidence is still missing?" And to offer a personal perspective, I wonder whether there is any evidence missing. It strikes me that there is quite a lot of evidence already, but I'd definitely throw that to you first, maybe Tom.
Yeah, it's a brilliantly put question because it should because there's just a ton of data and evidence out there. Clearly, the data is not enough in my kind of view. I think we need to get better at storytelling, and the Amazon example is a great one. This was somebody who is like the world's most famous business person, was deeply skeptical about advertising and brand building. He used to say it's a tax on a bad product, we don't do it. And then they learned from their own data that it did work. And now Amazon have built not a brand that is probably one of the largest advertisers and one of the best advertisers and brand advertisers to boot, and also has an enormous advertising business. That in itself is a phenomenal kind of U-turn, which should persuade somebody that this is a good thing to do. I mean, at the end of the day, different businesses will have different priorities. You do hear people saying, "I don't really need to spend money on a brand. I've got a perfectly successful business that is working without it." That's a choice. Some businesses don't want to grow. You'd be surprised how many, saw a bit of data once that said, of all businesses, only 30 actually want to wind, 30% want to wind down, 30% want to stay the same, 30% want to grow. Maybe they're in the camp that actually don't want to grow. Maybe ask that question. Do you want to grow?
Yeah, interesting. No, I feel like you used the phrase poking the bear earlier on, but
Yeah.
it really let's take the next one from Layla, because I feel like this is a good one for you, Grace, hopefully, who asks, "What are your thoughts on the impact of Google's third-party cookie deprecation rolling out this year on measurement, showing effectiveness, and being able to compare periods of before and after?" I guess to a broader theme, even if you can't answer to the specifics, the technological shifts which impact how we measure all of this effectiveness stuff.
Well, it's such an important thing this year that Google have been crying wolf about deprecating third-party cookies for ages, and now they're actually doing it. The wolf's with us. Some of those cookies have gone already. The rest are going to go by the end of this year for sure now. And what it means is for performance marketing people, the signal that they're getting is now degraded. It's not as good as it used to be. You're used to get quite a good signal to say, this person that I could serve a search ad to has seen a load of other interesting ads on their way to this point. And now, if I serve them a search ad, they're likely to convert. And so you could see who was the right person to target to. And you don't get that anymore because of the cookies going. All of the algorithms, whether it's direct data-driven attribution or multi-touch attribution, or even Advantage Plus and Performance Max, these AIs that sit within the platforms, they're all now only able to see last click like signals. So the signals are massively degraded. And what people are turning to is econometrics and market mix modeling. And I think, and I'm quite a positive person, but I think this is could be a really fantastic moment, because actually, if you don't rely only on cookies to tell you which advertising work, it means you can do things that are untrackable and see whether they work or not. So you can bring them into your mix. And I think a lot of businesses that have been performance only will make this transition because of the cookies going, and then suddenly start doing different and more interesting things, and they'll grow faster because of it.
Love that. It strikes me that we need another session another day about modeling and stuff like that, because I think that's endlessly fascinating and really optimistic, which is a fabulous outlook. I like the thought that our best days are ahead of us somehow, and both as marketers and people, you know. So thank you. I feel like, you know, we could carry on chatting all day, but we've taken our allotted time. So I just wanted to say thank you so much. You know, thank you so much to both of you, Grace and Tom, for taking the time today. Thank you also to everyone in the chat for contributing your questions, your chat comments as we've gone throughout. It's just really, really lovely. I also want to say a big thank you to Frontify. Once again, I'm going to flash their QR code up here. If you'd like the report on when to invest in brand from those 450 CMOs, do take the time to check out Frontify. They're very, very good people. Annika there is just an absolute hero. And also a big thank you to all of our sponsors, Frontify, Exclaimer, Cambridge Martyr College and Redgate. Thank you all for lighting up the chat with your thanks. I'm going to send that through to both Grace and Tom after today for a big old ego boost. Grace's course can be found here. And last thing is that I'm going to make sure we capture the questions and send them through to Grace and Tom, because Tom did a wonderful post towards the end of last year about the things that really matter on LinkedIn. And I figure the things that you're actually asking are the things that actually matter. So thank you all very much for today's session. We're back next week with Sir John Hegarty for a hell of an interview. And with all that said, have a lovely time. And thank you for taking the time today. Appreciate you all.